Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour, the member section. We are talking with Mike King from TomatoBubble.com. And I basically just want to go for the jugular here right away in the second hour and talk more about World War II, history, everything that was happening. This is a huge subject. People have been spending years, if not even close to lifetimes now, examining this issue. And there's just so many aspects to it. And we cannot cover it all in an hour. But tell us about how you approached the subject first. I guess it's always good to kind of see what the lead-in was for you, Mike, and how you came across some of the information and how you processed that, you know, from the kind of that psychological point of view we talked about before. Because you have a really good quote on your website that says, "When a well-packaged web of lies has been sold gradually to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous and its speaker a raving lunatic." It's by someone called Dresden James, but that's kind of where we are today, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm proud to be such a raving lunatic, but it was an interesting journey. For me, it just started quite by accident, really. It was just happened. I suppose it was years ago, maybe in the late 90s or about the year 2000. It was just before 9/11 when I stumbled across the first loose thread of this epic drama of World War II, and which I kept pulling and pulling and pulling and brought me to where I am today. Now, you're right, it is a vast topic. One thing I like to say about all the pieces on my website, and this is what I feel is my unique contribution. I didn't discover that World War II is a lie. There were authors and researchers far more eminent than me whose shoulders I stood upon. But I believe my unique contribution is to take such a vast subject and condense it into very readable, understandable, for lack of a better term, idiot-proof blurbs and photos, which could take anybody up to speed within a matter of hours. That's really the whole essence of all my works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Concise, hits you right between the eyes.
Well, how would you take someone through it that is grappling with some of the information and want to kind of understand the image better? Because it's very difficult to try to kind of, I guess, just let go of your preconceptions or the notions that you've been told before. It's very difficult to kind of reset that and say for a moment, okay, let's just look at it without anything of what I've been told in the past, and let's see if I can get a more objective view on it as opposed to just the propaganda version from one perspective. That's not something that's easy to do. How would you approach that?
No, it's not, and that's what prompted me to write Hitler Visits Oprah. Because by putting it in a whimsical setting like that and having – I present the story as Hitler tells his side of the story to Oprah. You don't have to believe it. This is not me saying this. This is Hitler's words. And indeed, much of what he says during that interview is taken from actual writings and speeches, which he made. So I write that in the introduction, that what no one can deny is that what Hitler says during the Hitler and Oprah interview is exactly what he would say if he were here today to explain himself. So that kind of disarms people a little bit. It's like, okay, let me hear what this monster has to say to Oprah. So the story starts out, Hitler comes out on stage and, you know, he takes Oprah's hand and kisses it like a gentleman. And people start throwing things at the stage and screaming and yelling, murderer, Nazi, anti-Semite, kill him, and so on. And then, you know, Oprah says, all right, calm down, you know, he is our guest. Let's have a seat, Mr. Hitler. And then they begin the interview. And right off the bat, and I did this deliberately, I wanted to illustrate a very easy to expose lie that could open people's minds up to the possibility of what other lies they've been told. So early on in the interview, Oprah Winfrey, she says to Hitler how offended she was that he disrespected, that he snubbed the the great black gold medalist, the sprinter Jesse Owens, during the 1936 Olympics. As the fairy tale here in America goes, Jesse Owens, he would win his races, and then Hitler would get up and storm out of the stadium.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so.
Now, of course, Jesse Owens himself, on multiple occasions, we have this in his own writings, disputed that story, reveals how when he walked past, he referred to him as the Chancellor, he waved at him. No, Hitler waved at him, and he waved back. And then we come to learn from a German sports writer who died just a few years ago. I mean, in his late 80s, he came clean. He said that Owens once showed him a photo of Hitler shaking his hand and asked if it could be published in the German press. And this was in the 60s. And he explained to Jesse Owens there was no way that could happen. And Jesse Owens just shook his head in disbelief. Hmm. But anyway, the story is a complete fairy tale. It's easily dispelled. And Oprah says, wow, that's amazing. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to accuse you like that. And then Hitler says, well, you're going to see that a lot of things said about me that aren't true. And then the interview proceeds from there. And Hitler and Oprah just asks him every question. She says, well, what about Poland? Why did you invade Poland? What about Belgium? What about Holland? What about the... So she's very confrontational and adversarial. And he just comes back with fact after fact after fact. And like I said, many of his responses come from his own words. And then by the end of the interview, he's won her over, plus the crowd. So it's a very entertaining piece. I've gotten enormously positive feedback from it. I had a lot of fun doing it. It's loaded with photos. And I'm telling you, you read this interview, you won't even realize that you're being entertained. There's a lot of comedy embedded in it, too. But, I mean, by the time you're done, you'll be an expert on both sides of the story. And I think even the most stubborn, brainwashed creature out there, at the very least, is going to wonder to himself, well, perhaps there was more to the story after all than I thought. So for many reasons, it's my favorite piece. It was the most fun, and I believe the most effective from the point of view of influencing people. Hitler Visits Oprah. There's a lengthy free segment at the website if people want to have a look at it.
Very good. Exactly. Now, the question of objectivity here in this particular question is something that I think it's important to reemphasize, because as we've been looking into this a little bit here and there, now and then on the program, I guess there's a worry by some listeners or some people who are looking at it that they're kind of afraid, because not only to look at it, but even to try to approach it objectively from an objective point of view, because they think that it's done in an effort to have, the SS troops march into our reality, or that it's a promotion of the perception of what the Nazi party was, that, yeah, let's go back there, folks. I mean, my angle to this is that's not what it's about. I want to understand it, because the truth matters. And I want to be able to be in a position where I can look at it objectively without all the lies that have been, put upon this by the Allies. And I don't see a danger in doing that, because one doesn't have to lead to the other. I mean, if we know that there's lies about it, then of course that disarms the topic or the immense stigma around the National Socialist Party anyway. But nonetheless, my idea is not to promote it per se. I don't even understand it at this point. So how could I even be in a position where I or anyone else for that matter promotes it? What about just examining it for what it is, objectivity, finding out, realizing that, again, the decisions that was made after World War II and those who run the world today, that it's largely due to what happened there. So I think I mentioned this before, but I think a lot of things, hinges on this particular historical event, and that's why it's so important to get to a point of objectivity of it. It doesn't mean, any of these other things that people think, or that you want to kill other people or anything like that. They go to such extremes just because you begin to question it. And I guess that's part of some of the psychological hurdles that a lot of people are facing, unfortunately.
Yeah. Henrik, I think the biggest fear of all, I mean, there's fear on multiple levels, but the biggest fear is the subconscious subliminal fear that if someone takes a close look at this stuff and becomes convinced of its veracity, well, all of a sudden, they become members of the lunatic fringe.
Right. Yeah.
Whether it's true or not. And that's really what terrifies people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what would you say as a resistance to the New World Order, and from the point of view of what Germany sought to achieve, and because if we look at their economic system, you know, much of what happened in, you know, countries today, for example, that don't have a central bank and are run by the international bankers, have been subjected to, not in the same ferociousness, but nonetheless, in some cases they have, but not quite to the same measure that Germany were subjected to. I think the economic question is a big part of this as well. The fact that it seems to me, in a way, that they managed to kind of throw off the shackles of the international banking system, take control of their own monetary system and their own currency, and they managed to build up something which no other country have done before. And this is that's when they crossed that line, when the entire world kind of turned against them. What would you say about that, the economic bit to this?
Well, Hitler's true quote-unquote crime was in pulling Germany out of this international loan-sharking usury monetary system. When he came to power in early 1933, he was faced with 30% plus unemployment. Germany was absolutely devastated by the onset of the Great Depression, far more so than the United States. Because at least people in America and other European countries, many of them had some type of savings to fall back on. But Germany, having gone through the horrific hyperinflation of the mid-1920s, you know, any savings the Germans had, I mean, they had to start from scratch in 26, 27 when currency was somewhat stabilized. So they were already kind of damaged even before the Great Crash. So there was something like a 250,000 suicides in the 2 years prior to Hitler taking office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's simply no exaggerating the level of mass suffering and degradation of this great advanced nation, or what was once a great advanced nation. And yet, within 3 years, Germany was close to full employment. And it wasn't the type of full employment you would associate with the communist countries where, you know, they give you a shovel, they say, go dig a hole somewhere and we'll give you some money and you're employed. No, this was real jobs. Most of it private sector. It was, I don't think there's a precedent for it in history to see a nation go from that level of misery and poverty and despondency to overnight prosperity in just 3 years. It's just incredible. And they did it with a debt-free monetary system. They did it with massive tax cuts. They didn't do it with military spending. That's another misconception people have. There was no massive military buildup during the 30s. All Germany did was they restored a normal military, because they had been limited to just 100,000 man military.
Mm, yeah.
Absolutely ludicrous for a nation of 80 million people. So this was mainly, I mean, the government was actively involved, but it was mainly a business-driven. The business class loved Adolf Hitler, and oddly enough, so did your average working Joe. So by 1933, he was immensely popular, not only in Germany but throughout the European continent. People were awed by his accomplishments. So this is a story that has simply been erased from history. Don't see. You know, there's a reason why the German people loved Adolf Hitler as much as they did. And it's not because they were, you know, brainwashed like, you know, people loved Mao Zedong or something.
Yeah, same exactly. They try to say it was some psychological disease of mass hypnosis, or some people go to the, it was like some kind of mind control. They were using some beam weapon to just, you know, kind of fool people.
This one Jew wrote an article that the Hitler mesmerized the nation with his piercing blue eyes. This is during the days of radio. How did he do that?
Right, exactly. Oops.
Oddly enough, one more point I want to make about that is when he came to power, okay, by no means was Germany united. The the Communist Party had like 5-6 million voters, and then you had the left-wing Liberal Socialist Party had just as many. So he was probably had a minority of support. He had a plurality, but certainly not a majority. And yet, within a few years, 2-3 years, his strongest base of support was in the very districts where the communists once ruled. So in other words, he won all the communist people over. Because you have to understand there's two types of communists. There's your evil, conspiratorial, Stalinist communist. And then you have your rank and file who are just decent people that just, you know, bought the lies, hook, line, and sinker about a workers' paradise. You know, they're not all evil. But he had won them over. So, and then that's amazing. He wrote about how all these political divisions are, you know, artificial. You know, we're Germans. We're all in this together. Working class and the entrepreneurial class.
Well, that's pretty amazing because, I mean, today we see that divide between economic liberalism and socialism, or as you said, kind of some more hardline communist factions, that it's a clear divide there. And one is like for the, you know, for the business class, and one is kind of for the workers or whatnot. Because I was wondering about that, what kind of system that they really had there. Is it what we would think of as a socialist system today, or would you say that he actually managed to merge it in such a way that it actually was beneficial? I mean, it seems like a contradiction today because we are so polarized in this conception here, but did he manage to merge it in such a way that it actually was beneficial to all, for the lack of a better term?
Well, yes, the socialism of the National Socialist Party should in no way, shape, or form be confused with the socialism of the degenerate Western world today. What we know as socialism today involves paying people to sit on their arse and make babies and be non-productive and vote for the politicians who pay them to be non-productive. No, that's not what Germany was about. Germany was about work. And it was basically free enterprise, but the role of the state was, when necessary for the welfare of the people, the state will intervene. So in other words, the National Socialist Party was said to the business class, go ahead, make all the money you want, but you're going to take care of your workers. And you're not going to produce things that's harmful. You're not going to make dirty films and make money off of it. So it was that type of... And as far as like social programs, like things like making it affordable for everyone to own a Volkswagen, or some of the vacation programs that they had for all the workers, you know, in essence, you could say that is a form of socialism. But you know, at the same time, everybody was expected to pull their own weight. So I guess you could call it a fusion between... you know, some of the more noble aspects of safety net socialism with free enterprise. But the underlying ethic, okay, which is the foundation of all of this, is what is in the best interests of the Volk, the people.
Yeah.
And that's what the National Socialist Party was all about. You know, some of these know-nothing imitation conservatives here in America like to say, oh, Hitler was a socialist. No, not exactly. I mean, when you have an interest-free currency, massive tax cuts, I mean, he was far closer to economic libertarianism than he ever was to Marxism. And that's why Germany made such a strong economic recovery. But it wasn't all about dollars and cents, okay? It was also about the culture, which is really where our ultimate wealth and happiness comes from. He promoted this ethic of we're one people, we're all in this together, take care of your brother, clean up all the filth, clean up all the pornography. He promoted the arts, the true arts,
yeah,
not the garbage modern art, Picasso and all that. So it was a cultural renaissance as well as the economic renaissance, and no less of an authority than David Lloyd George, former Prime Minister of Britain, visited Germany in 1936. Came back, he wrote a glowing editorial. He said, I have seen it firsthand. The German people are the happiest people in Europe. What Hitler has accomplished is a miracle. He called him, I think he called him a hero. It was just effusive praise from a British prime minister. And he wasn't the only one throughout Europe. So it was truly miraculous what Hitler had done for the German people in such a short time.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. There are so many things there about this we could talk more about. I mean, I guess at the end, the proof really is just kind of in the pudding of what they managed to accomplish before the war broke out. But this idea that what's best for the people is something that's so foreign to us today that we cannot even comprehend that and how that would work, because we've had such a corrupt leadership for such a long time that we just can't conceive of it. What do you mean? It's like it's almost like due to the fact that we have been living in the last, you know, 50, 60 years, you know, more than that. I mean, this goes way back in history, of course, but at the same time, just due to our experiences, we can't kind of accept that it's possible that someone was actually for the folk. They had the best interest of the people at heart. But that's very interesting. Was there one of the reasons why, I guess, Judea declared war on Germany is because of the kind of how they set themselves outside of the banking system and they scrapped usury and they had interest-free money and all that? Is that one of the main reasons, do you think?
Well, yes. Very early on, Hitler moved to take away the favorite toys of the Jewish supremacists, one being the usury-based monetary system, and the other being the newspapers and radio. Now, it's interesting. Throughout the 1930s, not a single hair on a single head of a single Jew was harmed in Germany. All that Hitler did is he restricted the ownership of the press, the control of academia, involvement in Germany's political affairs. That was set aside only for Germans. And the status of Jews was basically as, you know, legal resident aliens. But nobody bothered. They practiced their religion. They owned their businesses. I mean, right up until 1939, I forget the percentages, but it was 30-40% of the retailers in Berlin, retail shops were Jewish owned. I mean, they prospered. You know, there was no rounding up of the Jews. It was just a question of Germany is going to be run by the Germans. And that's it. And immediately, international Jewry declared war on Germany. And when I say declare war, I mean that literally. That's what they called it, an international declaration. There was a demonstration in New York. 40,000 Jews showed up at Madison Square Garden, screaming their heads off against Hitler. And this is in early 1933. I mean, he hasn't even set up his desk yet. So, but that's, you know, that's what started it. And all these fairy tales were coming out about Jews being oppressed. But what's interesting is by 34 or 35, even those stories disappeared from the Western press because they were so baseless and so unfounded. So then they had to switch gears. It went away from, oh, look what he's doing to the Jews of Germany. Instead, they focused on the imminent threat to his neighbors.
Haven't we seen that before? I mean, babies thrown out of incubators, weapon of mass destruction, you know, sitting at the UN holding that anthrax, you know, sample or whatnot. I mean, we're in the territory of the same, you know, type of strategies here, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's the same people. I mean, the names have changed, but it's the same PRC. I refer to it, the predatory ruling class. The PRC, which governs Europe and America today, is the same that governed during World War II and pretty much since the turn of the century, at least, you know, World War I. So it's the same tactics and, you know, it's the same people. They've just replaced themselves. They've just reloaded. I mean, and it's the same families in some sense, literally. You look at the New York Times, it's been owned by the Sulzberger Oaks family since 1896, and they still own it today. The Washington Post has been owned by the Meyer Graham family since 1933. So, and, you know, the Rothschilds, of course, go back 200 years. The Rockefellers go back 100 years. So, in a sense, it literally is the same people who put out these stories about Big Bad Hitler and Saddam with the, you know, with the anthrax, or Putin threatening Ukraine with nuclear annihilation. Same thing. And that is why it is so critical to understand the true story of World War II, because it's sort of like a Rosetta Stone. Once you got that down pat, you can look at current events and immediately decipher what's really going on.
Yeah, interesting. What kind of sources are there for people on this who want to look? Obviously, they can go to your website and read much more about this. But I mean, it's very, if they want to look into it for themselves, because as we know, it's very difficult to trust. There's a lot of back and forth. I mean, obviously, you have to try to approach the subject in such a way that you try to understand the different sides of the argument and you know, make determinations of what actually happened, what was the outcome of things. You kind of have to have the timeline down there, if you will. But is there anything you would recommend beyond your own website for people to look at?
Well, for those who are inclined to read 600-page voluminous tomes, and there's nothing wrong with that, and these were my go-to sources that I just kind of condensed.
Is it not available in a one-minute YouTube clip?
Yeah. Well, you know, in today's day and age with time constraints and attention spans, you know, that's why I condense it as much as I do.
Sure. Yeah.
At the same time, my work is not simplistic. So, but anyway, if you're looking for something really heavier and in depth, have a look at the works of David Irving, the British historian, Leon de Grel, who was a general in the SS. He only passed away like 10, 15 years ago. He knew Hitler personally. De Grel, D-E-G-R-E-L-L-E. So, you know, those are very lengthy works for someone who's more scholarly inclined and really, really wants to get deep into it. If you don't have that time, read my stuff, and it's all true, trust me. But one of the things I found, which is interesting, is my main go-to source for acquiring all the knowledge that I did was Hitler himself. I went back and read just about every speech I could find of Hitler's on the internet and many of his writings. And naturally, when you begin this type of research, I'm not going to take what one of the principals says at face value. But what I noticed early on is a pattern. I would read something Hitler said and say, well, that's interesting. I never heard that before. I wonder if that's true. And then I would look for an independent third-party confirmation of that. And you would often find it even in publications which were opposed to Hitler, like the New York Times, for example. So to give you an example, if you look at Hitler's final testament, written at the end of the war, just before he committed suicide, he writes in there, it's untrue that I ever wanted this war with Poland. I made numerous offers to Poland, which were more than reasonable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so you don't want to take that face value because, you know, Hitler's the devil and he said it. Fine. I found in the New York Times a summary of Hitler's proposals to Poland, and they matched up perfectly. So you see this time and time and time again. Eventually you get to the point, Henrik, where you could just read all of his speeches and that's all you need to know, because it's 100% truth. This man had no lying in him. And that's something else we can't relate to.
Yeah, in the modern day. Exactly.
But I'm telling you, try as you might, I challenge anyone to find an occasion where he outright lied or embellished. His words were true, and you can confirm anything he says from independent, neutral, or even hostile sources. And that I found was really incredible to me, really moved me.
Let me ask you about something else here. It has to do with the suppression of those who did not want this system, those who objected to it, and how severe that was. Because there's a question here, of course, of what is the right and obligation, because they have the citizen too, and at what level can the nationhood, the government of that state protect itself, because there's a lot of different variables there. Today, it's quite interesting to see that it's kind of, it's almost like it's a human right that you can do whatever you want, even if that means undermining the very government that, you're part of, or the country that you're in, or that you have to, you can be as subversive as you want and really work for the destruction of the nation, but it can't, you know, protect itself and do anything against you. That's kind of a little bit what seems to be going on. But you mentioned art, for example. We can talk more about what I just mentioned, but let's look at it from the point of view of art, because we have a kind of a similar thing more or less going on here in Sweden right now, you know, as they did in Germany with entartete Kunst, or degenerate art, as they called it. Because those who, we have an artist that's been very controversial here, and he just got arrested, put in jail for 6 months, because it was, you know, racial hatred. It was, he was prosecuted for this, and his art was meant to be sparking the debate about, you know, immigration and all these kinds of issues, and very on a very humorous note as well, which was something that was kind of overlooked. But nonetheless, those who want to see it censored have called, you know, him and the gallerist that exhibited the art for as Nazis. And then those people, like the gallerist themselves, have called the people who want to see it censored Nazis as well. And it seems that they're just kind of throwing this on everybody just because, you know, it's someone they don't like. And let's try to, you know, let's take out the Trump card, right, and throw that on them, the worst you can imagine. But what would you say about the art and like how the government suppressed people? What kind of stuff was burnt? What was, you know, admitted, or what was okay, what wasn't? Is there any way we can kind of try to get closer to what happened there?
Well, I mean, art was not banned. The degenerate art was not banned, but it was not promoted either. I mean, my understanding is, you know, these museums were shut down. The art was removed. But I mean, you know, the protection of one's culture is very important. And from the National Socialist point of view, to promote this kind of art was dangerous because of the debilitating effect that it has on the people. Because Hitler felt, and I tend to agree with him on this, I mean, I don't know if I would go to the point of banning art, but I understand the rationale behind it. If you can sell this kind of stuff to the people, if their judgment can be so, if they can be so deluded, they'll believe in anything. So,
yeah.
But it was a pollution in a sense. And
right.
And the Marxists have used degenerate art as a weapon. And why should a people, I mean, free speech is one thing if you have legitimate disagreement. But what the left is very skilled at is using the noble concept of free and open exchange of ideas, of using that as a weapon. So I think it's a case-by-case basis. You have to use reason to determine, okay, is this a legitimate difference of opinion where we can agree to disagree and all live happily together? Or are these people waging war against me, against society, against the healthy civilization? So when it came to the degenerate art, you know, the belief was that this was a form of warfare, and it was a form of warfare. Mm-hmm. And Picasso was an open Stalinist, you know, he was an admitted communist, drew portraits of, you know, of Stalin. So, you know, it's cultural pollution. So they regulated it on those grounds in the same way you might regulate air pollution.
Right, exactly.
But I think it's very simplistic, I believe, to just say any time that there's a call to censor something, just say, oh, Nazi.
Sure,
you have to look at it, you know, on a rational basis. I mean, would I want to censor a man and a woman having a, you know, Clark Gable, Scarlett O'Hara, Passionate Kiss, and Gone with the Wind? No. But would I want to censor the nudity and the pornography that's permeating our films? Of course. So we have to use reason to look at each case differently. Unfortunately, today we just played a Nazi card. the left and the right call each other Nazis.
It's kind of funny, I think, you know, that's been thrown around in that way. And it's kind of, again, it's saturating the whole debate there. But what about the protection then of, let's say, you know, because this has been going on for a long time, back and forth in terms of like subversive activities and spies who are trying to, you know, undermine the country. And people can understand that on the level of you have, you know, for example, a Russian spy in the United States or vice versa or something like that. But what about the political ideologies when we look at how, you know, people's right to let's say, undermine the country? Not, you know, not only them from the art point of view, but really literally from the political point of view, that if the objective is to destroy Western civilization, if the objective is to destroy the country that you're in, what rights, you know, can a country and that government or however you want to, even the people then ultimately who is you know making sure that the government is there, you know, etc. But what's their right there, do you think? Where is there a line to be drawn there?
Well, I believe it's the height of human folly to allow your adversaries to destroy you under the pretext of human rights, when they will not hesitate to destroy your human rights. So, you know, again, it goes back to assessing what is truly happening here. I mean, everybody has legitimate right to petition the government for grievances. But when you have, for example, these NGOs, these non-governmental organizations, which are fronts for the CIA, staging these quote-unquote spontaneous protests against Putin in Russia, okay, why should they tolerate that? They know what it is. They know it's not an expression of legitimate grievance. They know what's behind it. They know the intent is to destabilize it. So Russia had every right to shut these organizations down. And of course, the New York Times screamed about freedom of the press and human rights and so on. But a weapon is a weapon, Henrik.
Yeah.
Whether somebody is coming after you with a baseball bat in hand, announcing he's going to smash your skull, or whether they're using free speech to slowly and gradually gain power over you, democratically, quote unquote, and then smash the bat over your head, it's the same thing. And you have to treat it that way. But, you know, it's difficult because the left is very skilled at this Pavlovian conditioning. They start screaming about human rights and you're a Nazi and this and that. So it's very difficult to move forward on these fronts and to shut down what appear to be legitimate dissenters who just have a legitimate disagreement, and out and out subversives. Any state in a free country, especially in a free country, they have every right to crack down and hard on subversives.
It's a very difficult and delicate issue, because I mean, I agree with you there. I think it's you know, there are things as mind weapons, weaponized ideas that are you know, designed to create, you know, chaos, and that they're very corrosive in their you know, how they operate, you know. And then at the same time, of course, as we know, this could be applied, because this is what the this is what a lot of other countries are doing now, from the point of view of the cultural Marxism that we see, for example, they're using in that way as well. They see it as an attack upon themselves, and they're not afraid to stomp that out. I think it was discussions now in Sweden going around of banning certain parties to even have you know, public meetings or being able to go out and demonstrate on the streets, etc., because they consider it to be that. So as always, it works from both angles and everything else. But the question is, of course, how do you get to a state where people naturally by default can make the judgment for themselves without being manipulated, you know, either to the right or the left? That's impossible, right? We're on planet Earth. We're going to be influenced and manipulated and you know, kind of drawn into all these things. There isn't such a thing as a neutral, you know, objective point of view, really, right? Because it all hinges on what we've been taught, how we've been raised, the psychological warfare out there, the propaganda and everything else. So it's a tricky question, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky question when you live in a quote-unquote democracy, which really leads one to believe that perhaps the best form of government is one in which wise and virtuous philosopher kings and counselors protect the rights of the people.
Yeah, I've heard that idea too, and I've heard a lot of people are vehemently attacking that it would be some kind of, you know, ultimate tyranny, basically. But I would love to see some of the wisdom of our older folk, you know, being in more positions of influence. Today, it's almost like it's in reverse, and I think that's down for the cultural Marxist perspective as well, because, you know, you are more easily malleable when you're young. You fall for things. You I mean, look at the majority of the energy of the grassroots movement from Marxist point of view are younger, and then when you grow up a little bit, you do become more kind of, you ease off on that. Not always, of course, as we know, but you ease off on the rebelliousness, and you take other things into consideration. Today, it's like we we scorn the old, and we like we everyone wants to be as young as possible. The moms are like dressing up and going to Lady Gaga concerts with their daughters. You know, it's like the teenager is the role model now. You know.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. You know, one thing people need to realize, you know, we speak of democracy is these reverential tones. Ultimately, all forms of government are oligarchies. Whether the masses are manipulated into electing the front men for the true oligarchs, or whether the oligarchs rule openly and overtly as oligarchs, it's still the same type of system, because that's the natural way of things. A small elite class is going to rule in any form of government. The problem with democracy is that it's intrinsically dishonest, because people live under the illusion that they're the ones in charge. You see, but there is no, the people do not rule. It's always a tiny elite that rules. It's just a question: are you going to be governed by a virtuous and wise elite, or a predatory elite? And in a democracy, it's always the latter.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, there are some good books written on that, the failures of democracy, and the fact that it's been hailed as the greatest system. What is very difficult as well when we think about it, how different people are in their political ideas and even just basically of how they want to live their lives, and at the same time, so many kind of antagonistic points of view really that arise from that. I'm amazed that a country like the United States hasn't been more polarized yet, and even sooner, because to me it seems like the larger the countries we live in get, the bigger the regions are, the worse it is in terms of how you can being self-governing and determine how you want to live your own life, with whom, and what you want to do there. It's almost like I'm seeing, if there's anything that's going to develop in the future as we realize the failure of democracy, it's going to be that it's going to be breaking up more into smaller segments, where people will search themselves to the enclaves of where they find like-minded people. That's what I think is going to happen ultimately.
Yeah, man, it does seem in line with the natural order of things. There's just something intrinsically artificial about these huge, vast conglomerations of people, governed by a centralized source that way. You know, you just imagine what the world will be like if these globalists ever do realize their ultimate new world order. I can't imagine anything but a hell on earth.
I agree. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, still, I think, as we know, the nation state, yes, has been an artificial concept. I got a lot of flack from people for bringing this up as an idea, but I haven't explained properly what I really mean by that. And the point there is not to just go back to a system where we have an artificial nation. I mean, again, if we look at from Sweden's point of view, for example, we had probably 12, 20, maybe even more, like regions that existed, small kingdoms, really, chiefdoms that existed before they pressed for more and more centralization of the country, which later, formulated what is Sweden today. And even the geographical lines of this on the map has moved back and forth. But when I speak about nationalism, for example, I don't mean that artificial drawn line on the map. I'm talking about a nation as in a people, that there is self-determination there. They can live how they want and make up their own rules and judgments, as long as it's not an aggression against others, etc. I mean, that's a nation to me. And I think that smaller nations, smaller people and regions that, as usual, of course, they can be friends, they can trade with each other, they can, interact whatever way they want. It doesn't mean aggression necessarily, but I think people have that concept of it because they view it as the, how nationalism played out in the 20th century, which I still then to that degree believe is very much kind of artificial and was really hyped up as a way of taking us towards a global government. How do you view that, Mike?
Well, the globalists were very skillful in orchestrating two devastating world wars and then blaming it on nationalism when it was the nationalist leaders who sought to avoid these wars.
Right, yeah.
I mean, these wars were orchestrated for that purpose of uniting Europe. Yet, you know, you look at the so-called fascist leaders who were blamed for the wars of the 20th century, when in reality it was Britain that antagonized Italy, and it was Britain and France antagonizing Germany. So, you know, the fascist countries, if left to their own devices, would not have bothered anyone. I mean, later on during the war, it does appear that Mussolini exhibited some imperialist ambitions. But the great wars were brought about by the one-worlders and the globalists. And then they blame it on their adversaries.
Right.
Nationalism, there's no reason why nationalism should cause wars. I mean, if you love your own people and nation, does it therefore follow that you hate your neighbor?
Exactly.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. What about, I know it's, again, as I said before, it's a huge topic and we don't have endless time here today. We could perhaps even talk with you again in the future if you're up for that and continue the conversation. But what about the war that unfolded? Because you mentioned then, well, we're not being told about this, that there was an aggression against Germany, I think. And if people follow through logically on that, due to what happened during the First World War, and we saw the clear line agenda of blaming this on Germany and trying to squeeze them out and squeeze them in kind of into the situation to begin with. But it seems like it's kind of just it got out of control. It just was something where it began as a defense. They realized they had to do something in the regions that were talking about here, the Prussia specifically, Preussen, you know, and then it's something which escalated as Britain declared war on Germany, and then one thing after another, and then eventually it seems like Germany itself realized that, okay, well, our duty now is to destroy, you know, communism, and that's what, like, we have to do. That's what the goal became. And in that process, when that decision was made, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but if that decision was made, that's when it became like, all right, full-fledged war, we have to follow through this to the end. What do you think of that concept there?
Well, I mean, of course, like in the beginning, it was not time to go into all this, but Germany was provoked relentlessly by Poland. That's a fact. Indeed, the first casualties of World War II were German civilians who had been trapped in Poland since the end of World War I, when a huge chunk of German territory was given to Poland. But there's no question that Poland was the aggressor. The bigger picture behind that is why. What led Poland to believe that they could get away with humiliating and provoking Germany? And unbeknownst even to Hitler at the time, just 3 days before the outbreak of the war, Britain inked a deal with Poland that it would come to Poland's aid in a military sense if Poland should go to war with Germany. And it was at that moment that Poland really became aggressive. So that's how the war started with Poland, and then it began in the West with Britain and France, who ignored Hitler's repeated pleas to withdraw their war declarations. They kept building up their armies in northern France. Finally, Germany made a preemptive strike in the West. Now, when it turned into a war against communism in 1941, when it became apparent that Stalin was preparing a surprise attack upon Germany. And, you know, the evidence is clear here. You could have a look at my books, do some research on the subject, but there was a massive Soviet buildup along the German territories. They were getting ready to spring a surprise on Germany. Hitler just beat them to the punch. And that's when Stalin issued his decree to unleash communist partisan warfare. So now you had a full-fledged communist war against Germany, a war in which Germany, which Hitler saw himself not just as a defender of Germany, but of Europe itself. That was the role he saw himself as the protector of Europe against the communist onslaught. But even there, the war against the communists, against Soviet Russia, was not of Hitler's origination. It is something he sought to avoid. He was prepared to peacefully coexist with Stalin. It was only when Stalin made it clear that he had his own plans, that Hitler was forced to act, and that's why they went to war with the Soviet Union. So at every step of the way, whether it's Germany going into Poland or Belgium or Holland or even Norway and Denmark or Greece and Yugoslavia or North Africa or the Soviet Union, as difficult as it might be for somebody who's not steeped in this to get his mind around, the fact is every single occupation was necessitated as a measure of self-defense by Germany. They were being surrounded on all sides. So as crazy as it might sound, Germany was forced to occupy the continent in its own defense. And that's the truth.
It was a recent story. I got to publish this. I actually forgot about it, but I remembered now when you talked about it. It was recently was a story coming out that detailed the speech of King George, was it? And an early version of the king's speech reveals that Britain was preparing to declare war on Germany before Hitler invaded Poland. George the sixth address to the nation, depicted in the 2010 movie starring Colin Firth as a stammering monarch, had been written at least 9 days beforehand, which is quite interesting. Meaning that the speech was written before, but then when it actually occurred and happened, the speech was ready to go, right? And so it's another one of those events where you realize that the plot was laid out before the action of the events unfolded, you know?
Well, sure. Well, his predecessor, his brother, who's portrayed as an idiot in the movie, but actually precisely the opposite is true. It was Edward who was the stuttering, stammering fool, and they had to give him speech lessons because they were prepping him in advance to be a mouthpiece during the war. But anyway, his brother, who became king in 36, was an open admirer of Hitler. And Hitler even said later in the war, if it had not, had Edward not been forced to abdicate, everything would have been different between us and Britain. So that phony baloney story about the king giving up the throne for the love of Miss Wallace Simpson, you know that story.
Yeah.
Married an American divorcee, and because of that, somehow he had to give up the throne. No, that was all hyped up by the Jewish influence press of Britain and certain British warmongering politicians. They had to squeeze the king out. They failed in an assassination attempt that took place in his first month in office as king, which was, I think, January 36. But by the end of the year, they squeezed him out with this phony scandal, a scandal which broke in the front pages of the Washington Post, which was owned by the Jew Eugene Meyer. So they pushed aside the King of England, and they put his brother in there, who was just manipulated, and they made him give these speeches. So that was a big move, and that was unfortunate for Germany that the King was forced to abdicate. And then in 1937, now after he was married, he went with his wife to visit Hitler, and I have pictures of that on my website. So he even paid a visit to Hitler after he abdicated.
Interesting. Well, there's a lot more to this, Mike, and I think that but great. We can continue to talk about what happened during the war and kind of deconstruct some things, and of course get into to all the atrocities, what happened there, and try to kind of sort out some of the issues there. But why don't we just give out some of your details again here, Mike, before we kind of wrap things up for this time. It's been great having you on. It was a great conversation. So thank you much for, being here. Please let us know if there's something you'd like to leave us with on these topics or something else. And give us your website and tell us about the books again.
Okay. Well, what I would like to impress upon your listeners, and pardon me if this sounds like self-promotion, but I have to put false modesty aside and say I don't think there's anything on the net right now that can bring people up to speed on seemingly complex matters of history and economics and philosophy and current events in such a simple, quick, and entertaining manner as tomatobubble.com. And that's the feedback that I get. The site is growing by leaps and bounds, I'm very happy to say. And just for me, it's a labor of love. I mean, I live for one thing, and that's to get the truth out. It there's not a day goes by where all the lies just don't burn me up inside. But, you know, definitely it's worth the time to bookmark tomatobubble.com and just have a look at everything that's there. Other than that, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak with your listeners today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Mike King. Tomatobubble.com is the website. Head on over there, check it out. It's very, thought-provoking, a lot of interesting research and work there. We do appreciate you providing it for us. And, of course, check out the books there as well. We talked about some of those in the first segment there. But you have The God of Logic, The War Against Putin. We have New World Order Forbidden History, Hitler Visits Oprah, and also The Bad War, tomatobubble.com. Thank you so much, Mike, for coming on. Hope we can do it again in the future.
We will. Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your interest and, of course, for engaging in this kind of material, for your interest in truth and accuracy. And, of course, as we try to unravel what really has happened and what kind of world, consequently, we have due to the lies we've been subjected to. We have much more coming with Kevin and Benny from Joy Camp, Tom Goodridge, John DeNugent, Frank Salter, Kai Murrows, Matthew Tate, and many more. Thank you once again for listening. Thank you for being a member. And my special thanks to the team as well for their hard work. Have a good rest of your week. We'll speak to you in just a few days. Until then, please be well. Take care of yourself and your family and your loved ones. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.